This episode was recorded while the sun was shining on Wurundjeri land.
Hi everybody, welcome to another episode of Archimist Podcast. I'm your host Kimberly Ho, an architecture graduate and a writer who is interested in architecture's relationship with anything and everything. This season, I'm going to be talking about in terms of architecture's relationship with education and education's relationship with architecture and design, and how we go about teaching design with other people and sharing the knowledge as well. But before I start interviewing guests who are considered teachers, tutors, or mentors in our industry or in the world of design, I'm going to kickstart this season a little bit differently with the friend of the show, Dini Lee, who has been on my podcast several times. But as a refresher, as it has been quite some time since we've been doing this segment, Dini, can I please get you to quickly introduce yourself?
Yeah, so I'm Dini Lee. I'm currently a master's student at MIT, studying architecture, obviously, and I'm in my final year now. So, I mean, if you've listened to previous episodes, you've sort of seen me grow as a student moving into, coming close and moving into the practice, yeah.
Yeah, you've been a frequent visitor on my podcast in terms of we've had a lot of time capsule episodes and then discussing about different topics such as, you know, the infamous imposter syndrome. Yeah. And all of that. For this season, I think, as I said, when I first brought it to you in terms of the conversation, do I have the right to teach, just for starters and for an introduction as to why I wanted to do this season, is because as a student during first year, I know there's a bit of a gap between our education
timeline. Yeah, yeah.
I went into architecture education expecting that I would be taught by somebody who is in architecture field, keeping in mind that I didn't really know what architecture was. And so when I first went in, I was taught by a landscape architect.
Really?
Yeah, yeah.
Huh.
Wait, you didn't know that?
Nope. This is new.
Okay, I swear I spoke to you about this several times, and that's okay. But I was very puzzled when I first had that experience, and then I thought, does she have the right to teach me? So that was one part of the catalyst. And then the second one, which I think I've spoken to you about this a few times, was when I came back from Hong Kong. And I was going for a job interview, and basically the potential employer, when I left, my friend who eventually got the job, she told me later that after I left, apparently he said to his colleagues that he questioned my right to teach, whether I had any right to teach. Yeah, because I didn't have professional practice experience as well as, well, my experience overseas was pretty much project coordination and project management, and it's very different.
I mean, just on that, like, it's funny that you're getting me to sort of kickstart this whole season, because maybe the question is, do you have the right to teach? It's more about what are you providing to the students? Like, as you said, you had a landscape architect be your initial tutor. So there's formally, you know, they're going to employ you to teach because they think that, you know, you tick the box in their sense. But I think the assessment is more about, do you have something worthy to provide to the students who will then move into hopefully becoming architects? And if we always got like the same people who fit a very narrow definition or fit that the right to teach, that might also lead to a very restricted kind of teaching and what the students then became later, if that makes sense. So I wonder if it's less about you're valid and you're not, and more about what do you have to give to these sort of growing minds.
I mean, it makes sense because, to be honest, I don't know what that employer's education background was in architecture. Because if you look at different countries, so I would say in Asia, their education is very more technical side. So it's very much understanding the structure and all of that. But whereas in Australia here, well, at least for Melbourne, our education is very abstract and very creative. And so I think that back then when I first went into architecture, and I don't know, before I ask you a question of what is the expectation you had when you first started architecture school, I can't recall if you knew I was studying architecture when you started architecture.
No, I did, because we used to work at the uniform shop and we used to talk about that. And then I was like, hey, I'm thinking about doing this. And you're like, interesting, I'm doing that right now.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, no, it's funny. And I think that's how we sort of end up talking even more.
Yeah.
Yeah, go on.
Yeah, so it was just that, so I didn't know what I was going into, to be honest. So again, I was thinking I was going into skyscrapers, you know, designing the house and all that.
But maybe just before that, like, did you want to become an architect? Did you have an expectation of what you would be getting through your course?
Well, I really didn't know what I was going into, to be honest. It was just...
But did you want to do architecture?
I didn't know if I wanted to do architecture. Okay,
because that's what I was. I was like, this seems cool.
Yeah. That's good. But for me, right, the most infamous story that I've been saying this on record is that I was talked out of going into fashion. Like a lot of... I talked
myself out of that.
So like a lot of the women that in my cohort that year, it happened so that we went into architecture because we erred on the idea of going into fashion, but somehow somebody convinced us to go into architecture. So in this case, my mum brilliantly sold me the idea of maths and science, which I also love. And so she said, you love maths, you like science, and you also really like being artsy. Why don't you consider architecture? So...
I mean, that brings us into a, which we probably won't go down, but a separate conversation about how do people perceive architecture from the outside? But
I mean, we can still say we perceive architecture on the outside because as students, we were still coming in from the lens of how media portrayed it, right?
Yeah.
So that was my expectation, I'm thinking. And also in uni, you're generally taught by people who are in that profession.
Right.
I would say that is my semi-expectation, I think, going in because you have a lot of teachers... And even on open day, you have students or ex-students say, I was taught by this architect, blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
And you have these tutors who say, I work in a practice. So I think that cemented that idea is that you're going to be taught architecture or the foundations of architecture.
Industry connections. I can't remember what they say in the official open day stuff or, you know, on the website that they talk about, you know, you will be taught by industry professionals.
That is true. So that's where it got very confusing for me, right? When I had the landscape architect. It was only second semester when I finally had an architect teaching me. Mm. So it's a very different...
But just on that, maybe their strategy was it's getting you to start with big picture stuff and then zoom in.
Yeah. But not everybody thinks like that. I don't think. I think students kind of go in, you know how in high school we're taught, this is what we're going to teach you and this is what we expect you at the end.
Yes.
We're not really given that in uni, in my opinion.
Like, it's funny because I talk to different people about this more and more. It's interesting to hear what they have to say. When you're in a studio, what the other people in the studio are talking about and what their, like, little critiques are and what they're expecting, really, or what they're wanting or what's working. And then when you talk to, like, tutors or you talk to, you know, architects and that sort of stuff, what they're expecting, it's all very different. I guess it's all about... To me, it's like, what are you trying to shape the students to be? Because you're no longer a student.
Yeah.
It's almost like raising a kid. What are your values? What do you think that they need to learn about this world to then be able to thrive
in
it?
I just want to ask then, because we did do a several time capsule episodes, and I think a lot of our conversation was honing about how the curriculum was very different to what we expected in that.
Yeah.
It's not as technical as we expected.
And also... I wish it was.
Management, organization, time management, and all of that in terms of the student lifestyle.
But
I wanted to know, I know it's been quite some time since we have been first year students, but do you still remember what you expected despite our conversations we had when we were both in high school?
What I expected going into architecture?
Yeah.
I expected basically nothing. I had no expectations because it was a very like last minute thought of, oh yeah, architecture's a thing. I could do that, you know? It was good, though, because it was very, you know, I'll do whatever you put in front of me. So I think I remember having a lot of fun being stressed, but also having a lot of fun doing... In RMIT, we have a foundation semester where you sort of rotate between three different types of mini studios. And I just sort of threw myself into whatever came. I don't think I really judged the teaching at that point. I think later on. And obviously, as you do more and more things in uni, you have things to compare against.
Yeah.
So, like, at this point, it's interesting now to see the different ways, like, how different tutors and studio leaders teach. Just talking, it's about studio, not talking about other stuff.
Yeah.
And everybody also has their own approach. So you got to kind of respect that as well and, like, what they're trying to do or trying to influence and impart on the students.
Mm-hmm. I think it's fantastic the way you approach things, and it's a very considerate thought of it, because I'm trying to put myself back then. I'm wondering whether I have a bit more expectation on my tutors, because I used to think, probably this is based on experiences I had in high school, in which I've noticed some my friends and my classmates, their performance was heavily impacted by how the tutor or the teacher was teaching, right? Of course. So I would say that one of the reasons why I didn't continue in one of the subjects, I'd like to believe that had my tutor been different in the way of teaching and their approach, I think I would have continued that. I'll tell you which subject it was off topic, off recording. And it's the same that in uni, I'd expect that my tutor would be the one to, you know, bolster that confidence, bolster that enthusiasm. Again, you'll hear me say in a later episode with the next guest where I say that unfortunately some tutors, realistically speaking, do teach for the sake of teaching. There's different reasons. There could be ego. There could be the, you know,
financial. Sometimes they're just out of touch.
Yeah, there's a bit of that. And so for me, my expectation with my tutor is to keep me engaged with teaching. And I don't know if I'm asking too much about that, but I think as I progress, my approach to my education is I want to enjoy what I'm learning. And so the expectation of my tutor is that I hope they keep me engaged. I mean,
you're paying for the course. So I'd hope that you would, right?
Yeah.
Like, otherwise, firstly, I think there's two kinds of tutors.
Mm-hmm.
There's the tutor who wants you to be up to their level and do things in their way and see things their way. Then there's the tutor who sees that you don't understand stuff, like, you know, you're fresh to it. So they try to really, and I think that's probably the better tutor, is that, or teacher, that they want to sort of shape that and mold that rather than, you know, define it. Like I have a friend right now who's doing a studio where there's a lot of high expectations, and she's finding it really hard and frustrating because it's not exactly fair as well to her. But there's a certain bar that this tutor wants everyone to be at that is kind of inconsiderate. Whereas like right now, I'm quite happy with the studio I'm doing because like I feel that my tutor is a lot more understanding and conscious and aware of that and adapting to how we're going as students and trying to shape the teaching to that. So I think that's really important. Just something really simply is also, do you feel like you can talk to your teacher frankly? Sometimes if you don't, it really can stump your development.
You bring on that whether a student feels comfortable. It's going back to my conversation with Steve earlier on about stupid questions. It's forming that trust, right?
100%.
It's fostering that environment where the students feel safe. So I'd like to think that if I think about my experience teaching in person versus online, in person, students were kind of put in this proximity where they're forced to look at other people's work. So it's right in front of them physically. Yeah. And so a part of me sometimes wondered myself in terms of teaching, had I tutored differently, had I pushed them different, would they have a different outcome? But potentially couldn't have, because that's how much they ask of themselves, right? Because they have their own set of expectations.
Exactly.
But then when it's online, you'll hear me say this in another conversation later, is that these students, this is still first year, they don't know how to talk to each other, they don't know what type of questions to ask. And it was very simple for them to just shut off their laptops and not care about what other people did. I mean, it's their own prerogative at the end of the day. You're talking
about
when we had lockdown.
But you're talking about for students, for each other.
Yeah. It's just,
it plays a part in this though.
Yeah, because I think like in addition to us fostering that environment, but that I think there's external circumstances that sometimes can make it hard.
Yeah.
So for instance, students may not get along with each other.
Group work.
And all of that. Oh yeah, group work.
I mean, even with group work, like sometimes tutors just dump you with people, which I understand you. That's also fine, but it also becomes about what is the group work that you're doing, curating that. And just on that, because it's made me think about something else, is I think one of the best ways of doing group work, I think, is I had this studio where for the mid-sem, that mid-sem week, or maybe it was 2 weeks or 1 week, we did a crossover with another studio, and we all got paired up with somebody else from another studio, and we had to do a project that was covering both our, you know, studio topic and also theirs.
Mm-hmm.
And so it enabled us to firstly reflect on what on earth we'll be doing in the studio. And then also to, just for a short period of time, work with somebody else to produce the Bits and project.
Yeah.
So it was sort of a little blip in time. So instead of like, you know, you have three people working on this big project for your studio and you have to see them again later, it's like just a short experiment. And I think that was really good.
Under the guise of teaching, you were still sharing knowledge. And in a way, you were teaching yourself
as
well. And I feel that...
teaching each other, really.
Yeah, and I think that's part of what education really is. It's sharing ideas, because one of the reasons why I love teaching, I still do to this day, is the fact that I'm able to learn from my students while sharing the knowledge. Like, I feel very touched that they ask me for advice as much as I want to give them advice, but I'm learning their enthusiasms and their ideas to keep me motivated, per se. And it's also working with students. So something that I think worked for me in terms of first year teaching style, I'd love to teach other year levels going on, is I just wanted to know what they wanted out of it. Because I used to have this, I was guilty of imparting what I thought my tutors wanted as a first year on them. So I think that, like the expectations, I think
you weren't listening to what they're asking for.
Well, it was very different. So I started teaching as a second semester, right? Mm-hmm. And so I'd expected them to have the full suite of drawings. So as in knowing how to your line weights correctly.
Oh, they're still struggling with Rhino though. Like,
No, this was no Rhino. There was no Rhino. So they were still doing hand drawing for the first week of second semester.
Oh, okay.
Right?
Oh.
This is different. This is Monash. Yeah, so yeah, that's right. I think the expectations are very different per uni. That's another kettle of fish that we can talk about another time. But I was thinking, like, surely you should know your basics of orthogonal drawings in second semester. And I was very puzzled because I thought, but that was the expectation we were given when we were in first year, second semester, was that everybody knew how to draw, you know, the basic lines and all of that. And I realized that wasn't the case with the students. So I have to shift my angle and ask, what did you want to get out of the semester? I just want to know what your goals are. So if it's to improve on your hand drawing, okay, we'll work on these by, let's look at people who are really good at hand drawing, and these are the techniques you can learn. Some people want to improve on their Rhino skills because some of them started earlier. So I thought, okay, we can work on that. So that gave me also a benchmark on how I could grade their followers towards the end of the semester, was that you can produce magnificent drawings, but did you achieve it through the ways you wanted to achieve it? So do I see more hand drawings from one student, for instance? One went wild and used all these things in Rhino, and she did improve her drawings per se in the technicalities of using that. I guess that was me learning about how I could teach along the way to, you know, improve the students as I go.
I mean, going back to the right to teach, maybe this is me being biased, but I find that the younger tutors who have come out, like grads, and who have more closely remember what it was like to be a student, they are more open to doing that. Mm-hmm. For us, I find that people who have not been in that sort of student or university or even academic sort of realm, they just get very detached and they can't relate.
Like the relevancy.
They're in their own little world and you're like, what are you on about sometimes? But that's also a question of, you know, are you preparing them for the industry and for office? And that's a whole other thing we could get into.
No. I think that's a really valid point, because stereotypically speaking, societally speaking, right? The expectation is you go into uni, study what you're going to work for, and when you graduate, you get the job of what you studied, right? And so I think that's one of the biggest expectations students have before, like, unknowingly, right? We've been graded this since we were, like, what, 15, 16, when we had to pick our university degrees.
I think also, that's relevant. I mean, this is a big gripe that me and friends have been talking about, and it seems to be the hot topic. Like, there's such a big divide between the university and the academic realm and, you know, industry and the discipline, you know, practice.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of us struggle to jump between the two.
Yeah.
And there's this missing middle part. And that's possibly one of the big complaints about teaching. And that's possibly why people critique younger, like yourself, people who are graduates or whatnot, who are teaching, because they're like, oh, well, you don't have the experience and practice to then teach. Well, it's like, yeah, but there is a big missing middle.
Yeah.
And so I think, like, I'm, at least the point I'm at is that I appreciate your, like, teaching me, because you are also in part mentoring me as to, like, what's that transition like and what to expect, rather than just being left in the lurch. Strangely, I think that, at least for MIT, I just thought about this the other day, that the course is really gearing us up for something more akin to competition, like doing stuff for competition. I don't think it trains us as well for practice.
But do you think the expectation for uni is to train you for practice? Because realistically speaking, right, it's not just architecture. There's other industries. So some of my friends in, you know, the finance, I mean, I guess medicine is a very different thing because live specimen, live people, and then therefore you have to practice in person. Whereas for a lot of us, don't really get the industry experience that we want until we finish our course. Or in the case of architecture and design in general, not every student has the initiative or has the chance to
DIY
work. It's very much independence, right? I think university in general asks you to be independent, whether you like it or not. And I think it comes as a time of whether we realize
it. I don't think they ask you. I think they just
let you
leave you to be, right? They're not that considerate.
No, fair enough.
I talked about this with somebody else and they were saying that, I don't want to steal their point, but it should be an apprenticeship. I mean, it was sort of moving a little bit away from the teaching thing, but like if practice is quite different and the expectations from practice as well as students and graduates is something different to what is actually being taught and how the students are being trained before they come out, then maybe there's something that needs to be solved there. On both the academic university world, their responsibility and also the practice. But there's, I don't know, I feel like students are getting caught up in between and graduates. In the crosshair.
Bit of a tangent then, just a bit of a detour, but it kind of makes me think about my conversation with Elliot. We talked about him moving from architecture to building design, and it's that how both of us wish we had elements from each course. So Elliot being that he would have liked a little bit more design, whereas for us in architecture, we would have liked a little bit more technical, even though we do have prof prac and tech.
But
the realism of
there's still that. So much more to learn. Like, I feel like a noob sometimes, like talking to trades and even talking to, you know, being in office and trying to draw stuff, just feeling inept sometimes. But also remembering, like, you know, there's still a lot to learn. But I also understand that you've only got however many years to, like, to be taught. Like, you can't spend however long, you know, just drawing details all day long. Although my friend did do an elective that was about details. But maybe it's just leading to another question of, like, you know, our course is 3 years and then 2 years, bachelor's and master's. Is Monash the same?
Yes, Monash is the same, except I don't know if RMIT does this now, but you've got people also coming from a different course.
Yeah, we do.
But their year is that they have to do 3 years of master's, but one of the years is a foundation course, so then afterwards I can do the 2 years of...
We have people jumping in from building design until about, I think it's second year.
Sorry, I wasn't clear. I was referencing those who are coming from a completely different discipline, so law.
So you guys have an extra foundation,
for those people.
I don't know if we have that. I feel like we might not.
Yeah.
Yeah, so if you've got that much time, right, you add up all the time, you know, what do you want to teach these people then?
That's a good way to throw it back to the
students. You've only got, you've only got a certain period of time. Well, like, you know, you've got 15 weeks of a semester.
Yeah.
What do you do with it?
Okay, let me ping pong that question back to you. So after the first year, and I'd like to think that because the luxury of we had when we were in uni is that we get to pick whichever studios we want. Yeah. Because that was giving us a bit of autonomy of how we want to shape our architectural identity. Should we?
Do you think balloting is good?
It was very political in our year. I mean...
We'll come back to that.
Okay, the balloting thing, let's be realistic. Sometimes you can't get everything you want.
No.
So I think But
do you think that we should, like, if we don't know what we're doing yet and we're a bit inexperienced, should we be allowed to pick?
But then it comes down to, did first year equip you enough to give you an idea of what you want to design and what you want to do, right? So I think it works both ways. I mean, there's that question of what happens if there were too many people in one studio and then the other one had none.
I don't know how Monash do it, but we have like three different veins of studio. So like there's the, I don't know what the actual words that they use, I cannot remember, but there's like the more like urban-y sort of stuff. There's like the more parametric stuff, and then there's like the more conceptual weird stuff, which I tend to end up doing. Yeah, like I always wonder, especially at the start, like I don't really know what I was doing, so I just picked whatever. And then after a while, you're like, oh, I don't really like that. But like that's sort of wasted time sometimes.
Do you think that the other electives, the other subjects that we have been, because I don't know about RMIT, so for us it's studio, and then we've got comms. So yep, comms gives us a bit of a taste of parametrics, et cetera, et cetera. And then you've got your tech stuff. So I'd like to believe those side subjects would also impact what you would choose.
I think they do. Right? I mean, the parametric thing from comms really put me off it.
I think it happened with a few people.
Grasshopper, ooh. I don't know. I think it does, but not enough personally that I feel that it does for me.
Yeah.
I think we've had some things we'll talk about that we've totally just veered off from.
That's okay. I don't
want to recircle.
If we think about it along the lines of teaching, it's more that those tutors were putting their personality and then you get an idea of what they want, right? So I know this, we're asking a student's perspective of who has the right to teach, but I think it also highlights that there are different factors to education, right? Because you have to coordinate a lot of things in order to make a syllabus work, and we're only seeing a blip of it.
But I think it's also important that we comment. Like, it's funny because on one hand, you could argue the student doesn't know, like, they're a student. They don't know what they should get in terms of teaching. But on the other hand, it's like, we're the ones who you're teaching. We should be able to, like, yeah, that ain't working, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
To review it.
I guess, as every uni would always do, is asking at the end of the year is, this is the result of our cohorts. Do we think we're going to get that? Or do we think we'll have that statistic of 90% of our cohort got into the profession that we've taught them?
Oh, right.
Do you get what I'm coming from? Because I feel that that's what they've always marketed in uni. I still remember some of their billboards saying, be part of that demographic that gets into the job that they would teach.
We've just recently got like ranked number, I think it's like number one in Australia, number 18 in the world for the architecture school and urban design, and they've plastered it everywhere. It's so, I mean, it's good, but it's like really funny it's how it becomes the marketing tool, right?
Yeah, yeah. And so, okay, I will say this because this is a catalyst from third year where the reason why we talk about balloting and why I say it's very political and you're challenging us whether that's right. So the reason why it's very political that year is that we had one studio that everybody wanted, and the rest of the studio, for some reason, the way they advertised it sounded very Can't talk to you about what subject it was, but those who were in my year will know. And you know about this clearly. But we knew everybody wanted that studio because we loved that tutor. They were amazing. And we know that they're a great educator. Fun fact, they did work in practice, but then I think they've now become an academic. As well.
Yeah, it's quite a few people like that.
Yeah, and so it's interesting. We'll talk about that shortly. Basically, we knew everybody really wanted to get into that studio. So we all just did the ballot. But then when you saw the results of who made it into the class, there was huge uproar because it was very evident. It was very handpicked, right?
Oh, okay. Go on, go on.
It was very evident because of the group of people we knew. Because we've been in classes with them, we knew what type of architecture and style that they would do. And so therefore, we just knew it was very, very political. And my friend told me eventually, education, unfortunately, is the biggest playground for politics.
Where there's people, there'll be politics.
That's a good one. But I will say education is currently, and in Australia's climate, the biggest political bargaining.
Yeah, exactly. Right? Exactly.
And basically, and I was curious about that, and I try not to think about that because I think that would put me off from my disappointment towards my institution, right? Well, try not to.
Do we have hope? Like how much are we critiquing that we're upset about, and how much, you know, do we love and have hope for?
I mean, I've left uni a long time ago, but I think it's just that I unfortunately ended up to use the knowledge of politics to my advantage when I was in my master's.
You've got to survive.
Yeah, you have to. But I think it's just that in a sense, then it's also coming down to, okay, students questioning, I think it's a bit of a reflection. I'm just trying to think of this wording in the nicest way possible, is that I think sometimes we can admire tutor, but even though we admire them because of what they do, at the end of the day, we might not be compatible in terms of learning from them.
Yeah.
So yeah, we have to think about the teaching styles as well. Because if I reflect on it, as much as I didn't get that, I was part of that cohort that did not get into that class, which is fine. I completely understand why. You weren't
salty about it.
It was just like, oh, this sucks. Because I've been really lucky that I've been getting all my first preferences. Right. But then the more I think about it, I'm just like, look, I'll make do what I've got in the second semester because I've got my second preference at the end. Biggest learning curve during that semester as well, which was really eye-opening and rewarding. But in hindsight, I can see why I wouldn't have worked out in that studio.
Yeah, anyway. Sometimes it's like, oh, it's good I didn't get that.
It's hindsight, which is the most annoying thing, right? I think sometimes when going back to the title, do they have the right to teach? Do I have the right to teach? It's sometimes people don't think like that. It's because we may not be compatible with that student, vice versa.
Sounds like a relationship.
Did you have to put it like that?
Sorry. Cut that out if you want. I mean, they're all kinds of relationships, right?
I mean, it's true. It's just that it's the, oh, I don't want to use this word, but it is chemistry there. We're not talking about romantic relationships, okay? Shush. It's just understanding that you can't get along with everybody at the end of the day. For instance, my final semester tutor, unfortunately, I was very burnt out during that semester and I got into a lot of fights with him, like screaming matches because I used to get really angry.
I think I remember you telling me about this. But
yeah, I mean, it's not my proudest moment. For some reason, it never happened when we're in a class setting, as in we don't have fights if we're outside of class because we were able to have a measured conversation. But once we're around a lot of people, he gets really anxious. And next thing you know, our voices just escalate around each other.
The fact that you can actually have a fight is incredible, though, because it also means that
it's very out of character for me.
No, but it means that usually if you were to have a fight with your tutor, you would probably either get it, you both would either get in trouble. So it's kind of interesting, though, because maybe it also suggests that
I don't know
that just they respect you enough to bother having a fight with you.
Yeah, I think it's just that in hindsight, I feel like I've risen my voice several times and I know that they've risen their voice several times. I can't recall. All I just know is that it was a very difficult semester for me, and I think that just tried to erase all of that from my mind. So
block it out.
But I think that the one thing that really changed my perspective of them was I got this email telling me to rest up because I was just so done by them. And I think that that's when I say they know that I'm trying my best at the end of the day, so it's fine. Even though
so were you all cool after that? Or
I mean, we still respected each other at the end of the day, so it's fine. Like, we still greet each other formally. We did get the chance and whatnot, right? What I'm trying to say is that probably from my perspective back then, there was a period of time where I don't think he should have been my tutor at all.
Mm-hmm.
But then there are times where I felt if because we were in a different environment, I think that also plays a huge part of it. Because when it's just one-on-one, we were more calm, and different times of the day where we're less hectic about everything, we were able to have a civilized conversation instead of us just, I think it was rising anxiety between the two of us.
Yeah, I mean, you're under a lot of pressure as a student. I think definitely in architecture school, we all put ourselves under personal pressure as well.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's the additional pressure of your tutor and your whoever is teaching you your subjects. There's maybe this inherent thing for architects that you want to be not the, you know, we're going to solve all the problems and save the world, but there is a bit of it rests on your shoulders.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, couple that all together, and you get that level of like tension and stress and burnout and stuff. I think I'm probably still going through burnout. I think also for teaching, it's the ability to recognize that in your students is important. I mean, going back to the right to teach, it's a lot to ask of somebody or to tell somebody, like that person who said about you that they didn't think that you should be a tutor. That's also a lot of pressure.
I think the
school has also got pressure on you, like, you know, we've employed you to teach, so.
Yeah, that's true.
Don't mess it up.
I think about the pressure and expectation. I think that is the subtext of who has the right to teach, in a sense. So it's potentially the reason why that person said it is because their experience was pretty much a very different expectation. So I would say that they may have been taught by a professional and that's how they got to here today.
Mm.
So that's why he thinks it's only those people that have
it. But to a certain degree, you can get taught by all these people and go through the course, but that doesn't necessarily make you a better outcome than somebody else.
That's true.
It's also what do you decide to do with it?
Yeah, it's the guarantee. You can't just expect a tutor to give you the key to success. Mm-hmm.
Some people just try to cruise through the whole course like that. And it's like you need to ask yourself, what is it going to be? Like, what are you going to do with it?
But realistically, not everybody's going to think like that, right?
No, no.
And unfortunately, I mean, this is probably coming from a bit of envy and a bit of resentment, is that there are some people like that and they end up doing very well career-wise, career progression.
Sure.
Kudos to them because they've got other skills that they can use to get them to where they need to be. Yeah. But then I think we're talking about, you know, again, you say pressure. I think students also have that pressure of getting the job because of the societal expectations that we've been fed, right? So, therefore, it's the reality is that it's a domino effect of different pressures that therefore we have this very weird and very critical eye towards what education in the world of design or in general really is about, to be honest.
Realistically speaking, the people who are teaching are being employed by the school. The school is allowed to even have teaching because of, I can't remember who, but there's some sort of government body that will assess every, like, I can't remember, it's like 4 years or something like that.
Oh, yeah.
You know, they come in and they look at all your, what you're doing and da-da-da-da and what's your prof prep course and et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
We learned about this and I totally forgot. But, you know, those people who are a part of that government body, they also have their own idea of what should the students be getting out of this? What should you be teaching?
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting as a hierarchy, but then how do you, you know, what's the conversation hypothetically between the student and that person? Because they're at two opposite ends. So, but actually they're looking at the same thing and their interests are actually the same.
Yeah, yeah.
So in a fictional conversation, what should that conclusion be?
I mean,
are they on the same page?
When you mentioned that, if I recall correctly, I was actually sitting on that body one time.
Really?
I actually got asked ages ago, but what I expressed was disagreed by a lot of the students. So one of them was, I still remember being dismissed and I got a little bit annoyed, but at the end of the day, to each his own opinion. But basically I said, I think this is me coming from somebody who was desperately looking for a job. So this is reflective of my expectations of, you know, getting into
architecture. Time and place.
So I said, well, I think we need to be taught in terms of Revit skills, ARCHICAD,
right,
things like that, because we need to be prepared to enter the industry with a bit of that knowledge, because that's what a lot of the job posting is asking for. But then they dismiss it, say, I don't think that will help us getting anywhere.
I mean, that's a question of measuring success.
That's true.
Because some people are going to measure the success by how many graduates get jobs and, you know, how many of them are able to stay in architecture.
Again, going back to the marketing, right?
Yeah, I mean, of course, because money as well for the university. But we were talking earlier separately about, just lost my train of thought. Maybe I'll come back to that. But so on one hand, you know, there's the greater stuff about we need to generally improve the industry or be introducing new ideas, and we do this through the school.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, it's like we need to make sure that the people who came here under the impression of studying architecture to become an architect and therefore get a profession, a job, that also needs to be fulfilled. So, okay, that's what we're talking about separately. So we talked about, you know, things like redundancies and graduates and that sort of stuff, not being able to get jobs or really struggling because it gets very competitive because there's so little. So if that's a problem, and if one of the, you know, definitions of success is we need to be able to, you know, get a good percentage of those people into a job, like, I think we're lacking there. And maybe this is the critique again. Like, there's so many people, it feels like, at least to me, that are moving out of architecture or sort of getting cynical or disillusioned about it.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder, do we need to reevaluate that and what our definition of success is, and how can we support that if we're rebuilding the criteria?
Mm.
I don't know if I've said that right, but like,
I think it's a good way of saying it, because then this is, I guess we'll wrap up our conversation with, because we are nearly we always go over time whenever we talk.
Yeah.
Very typical. Is what do practices expect out of our architecture education?
But then I think that's twofold again, because one, it's like we need an employee to work. And then there's the other thing of, I think at least in architecture, there's always this, and definitely in schools, is like, what does it mean for the industry as a whole?
Yeah.
Are you just employing another, I think they call them rabbit monkeys or whatever.
Cat monkeys.
Yeah. Or do you want that person to be intelligent enough, resourceful enough, and, you know, all those other qualities in your office? Or are you just looking for another draftsman?
Yeah, but then there's also that question of, you know, how I used to express my frustration with jobs is they want people with experience, right? Mm-hmm. And it's not that everybody has the opportunity to have that experience. So then it's the matter of whether they're willing to, well, if they have the resource and time to reach out and provide that teaching environment. Because even though we're a bit insular in this conversation is that we're focusing on the tertiary education, but keep in mind that people are constantly learning every day.
Yeah.
So my next question is, as much as what we can do for the employers, because I know we did get quoted in another podcast where they said that it's a looking of whether what we can do for the firm instead of what they can do for us. But I think it's equally as important that the firms need to think that as much as they have the upper power of hiring us or not, but we also have the power of giving a good reflection of what that firm's going to be at the end of the day to an extent.
Well, as someone who's, you know, when I graduate, I'll be working again. I realize that for a lot of us, we need to be trained in a certain way. And that's not just, do you know how to use Revit? It's like, well, if you're not satisfied with the student or the students as a whole, there's also a degree of you're going to have to want to train them in your particular way as a practice, because every practice is a little bit different as well.
Yeah, for sure.
So you also have the opportunity then to really train somebody exactly how you want them to be, because that's your expectation of what the student should be coming out as, or graduate should be coming out as.
Yeah.
So there's also that level of teaching and that level of
management.
Yeah, and maybe it's also the question of, did they have the right to teach?
Precisely.
You know, full circle.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think that employers need to be asking that question. Do you want somebody to come in and just be default setting, you know, pump out whatever that they're asked to do? Or do you want them to be trained to your particular way that will work better for you, but also help to train them as an individual, as a, you know, graduate?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's a really good one, and I really want to talk more about this because
running out of time.
I know. I just probably one way for me to cap off is that, again, at the end of the day, to conclude our episode, there's many facets of teaching. Everybody has the right to share their knowledge. They're qualified to some way to impart their experience, because at the end of the day, we can all contribute something in terms of knowledge.
It's all useful.
It's experience. We're imparting our experience with other people. But then we also need to consider, it's not just the tertiary aspect of it, it's the external aspect of it. Are you being mentored correctly? Well, are you being supported? Are you being managed correctly, or at least managed with well-being at the forefront? Because it's person by person experience at the end of the day, right? Whether somebody is being noticed or somebody who's being trusted to do more things or given more opportunities. Because at the end of the day, it's people is politics.
Yeah.
That impacts our experience and work. And I think we can't just blame university. I mean, that's
the seed of one. There's a lot more nuance to it.
Yeah.
But it's when it's happening more and more and more that there's a trend that's when, you know, that's when the bigger thing needs to be reinvestigated.
I think it's a very top-down scenario, because I think, as I did say, it's imparting one's experience. But then when you impart one's experiences, whether you're imposing those lens, you're passing that lens to another person. And so this is the lens that they're unfortunately stuck with. So, you know, I don't know whether all-nighters is still a prevalent thing.
Well, not personally, but I definitely know other people who do that.
Yeah. So using that as a benchmark or an example, right? Mm-hmm. That is imparted because of what previous people have been used to. And even though we tell them not to, it's still being, it's a cultural thing. Yeah. I would say, in like design wise, that's a type of cultural thing. So I think there's heaps of factors at the end of the day. We can draw a wide web if we want to.
We can't solve it.
No, we can't. But if we understand.
Not in a podcast.
No, no, we can't. Look at us trying to be altruistic, right? And as much as we want to, but I hope for this season, we get to understand the nuances that makes up our education and how we learn. In terms of under the guise of the world of design, while using that as a framework, because education is still a very tricky thing. It's not something we can get right overnight, but I just hope it continues to facilitate this conversation on what it means to share knowledge or teach as well.
I'm excited.
Yeah, thank you. I'm just curious to know in one sentence or two, because I know we can talk a leg off a chair if we wanted to.
Yes.
What do you think, what type of traits or what type of qualifications or experience do you think a person has the right to teach or share knowledge?
I think I'm speaking from where I am in my course and as a student, but I think firstly, they need to remember what it was like to be a student, at least aware enough to be considerate of that. I think the other thing is you need to have experience and practice. That doesn't just mean like, you know, I've had 10 years in practice. I think it's also understanding what are the problems in practice, what are the benefits, what are the things that, you know, being able to draw out the things that then you can impart to your students from that experience and practice, not just being stuck in that world and not really understanding what the status quo is, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And then I think you need to be empathetic. And that doesn't mean that you're a pushover. It just means that, as you said, like with when you were experiencing, you know, a lot of frustration and you had this whole, this is more than a sentence.
That's fine.
This whole argument with your tutor. It's like they need to be able to understand that and be empathetic rather than being rigid, because nothing is more frustrating than when you really don't know and you don't understand anything and the tutor or the teacher is just kind of ignoring that call for help.
Okay, now I'm questioning whether I have the right to teach because I did teach without having to work properly in an office.
I'm talking idealistically.
Okay, so the ingredients.
I'm not the school setting a baseline.
I'd like to think that you share a similar view with some of your peers if you've had conversations with
them. Yeah, we've discussed this. Different people bring different things to the surface, but I've talked to several people about this sort of stuff.
Mm-hmm. No, I understand because the thing is, again, I probably didn't have some of your criteria of what you wanted per se, right? So I wouldn't have.
So what's your thing?
My thing.
Who do you think has the right to teach?
Okay, so I'll put three categories. So if I was saying in first year, probably ideally somebody, again, empathy is very important. Mm-hmm. And I think somebody who outlines the expectations, so has a bit of clarity and organization.
Yes, because you're setting them up.
Yes, in terms of setting them up. And practice experience is preferable, but I think in hindsight, I can understand why we were introduced to different types of professions when we first started out. So that's first year. Second year, ideally somebody who has had the practice experience, at least a little bit of realism, because as we get into second and third year, our projects have to become a bit more realistic in our approach, right? So a little bit more realism, professional practice, again, understanding. And I think is coming from a very independent person. I'm somebody who likes to improve themselves, self-improvement. Yeah. So a part of me doesn't want to depend on my tutor so much, but they're really good at guiding, per se. Not imparting.
As you get older and you spend more years in the course, you need to have people who will sort of just push you in the right direction rather than lead you.
Yeah, yeah. Don't put your lens of what you want my outcome to be in comparison to, okay, this is two forks. You can choose either one of them and you'll get different results, but that's up to you. Yeah. And that's fine. I'll support you along the way. And then for masters is that I think there's a bit more expectation in the realism as well. So professional practice is still important. Mm. I mean, guarantee that. I think it comes down to don't detach yourself away from the realisticness of it. You can have academic teaching masters, but I think sometimes they forget about the realities.
I think because you're approaching that world of practice even more.
I think it's just understanding and being realistic of what the students are going through. I think empathy is the underlying of it, but then I think as you teach slightly more advanced, it's probably more beneficial, because I've had a similar conversation with a friend and they did express that it's probably a bit more beneficial if they had longer practice experience, because they can answer more complex these questions, because students get more intrigued and more complex in their way of
designing. They know more, so they're going to ask more.
Yeah, so I think that's what the recipe is for an ideal tutor, per se. So...
You're asking a lot.
Again, I'm very grateful for having you coming on board to enter this season, because this will set a very important foundation and questions for the rest of my guests throughout the season. And as always, Dini, I'm really appreciative of you and your insightful comments. So thank you.
Same to you.
So as always, do you have any media handles you'd like to plug or share?
I don't know, I might pass you some stuff later if I think of it.
Sounds good. And then as for us, it's Alchemist in the Making, all in one word, on Instagram. Please follow us if you haven't already. As always, please subscribe as well. It would mean very much to us so that we can reach other audience and perhaps question or make them question who has the right to teach in general, be it design or not. But in the meantime, please stay safe and curious as always, and we'll see you for another episode. Bye!